Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT Photo with Catherine Hall, episode 13, recorded June 21st, 2011. Ed Cashy. TWiT Photo is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 30% off your new account for 3 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWITPHOTO6. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/TWiT. It's time for TWiT Photo. Here she is, ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, Ms. Catherine Hall.
Hello, everyone. Hey, welcome Catherine. Back.
Listen, you got a round of applause. That's great.
I feel good. I feel loved.
Oh, yeah. This is so nice. So for those of you who tuned in and say, what happened to Lisa? And mostly, it's, Lisa's suddenly got some hit iOS apps, The Heist and Camera Plus, and she's very busy right now. She'll come back from time to time, but I'm thrilled that we can bring Catherine Hall in, who's one of my favorite photographers, to helm the show. And because Lisa Bettany is mostly Lisa, we thought we'll have to change the name to TWiT Photo.
I like the new name.
Do you have, we could be Catherine Photo.
No, TWiT Photo.
TWIT Photo. I like it too.
I like it. It has
I
a
like
nice
it
ring.
Too. And so this is your second, your fourth show, but your second time at the helm.
Second hosting time. So I'm welcome. Still learning.
You have arranged.
I'm a little nervous.
Are you nervous? No.
Oh, okay. I'm medium. Ask Tony. He knows.
Tony Wang, our producer. He's sitting there. He's hovering over you, making you nervous.
No.
That's what's going on. So tell, we have today's, by the way, the format of the show as we go forward, I think I love this format, which is we find a great photographer and we gang up on him.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
That's it.
And you have a list,
we
a long
in their
list.
Brilliance.
We've got some great photographers coming up.
Legendary.
I'm so excited. Bruce Dale from National Geographic is going to come. You have any other ones you want to tease? Or?
Well, next week, we could maybe let that out of the bag.
Okay.
We have Art Wolf next week, which I'm super stoked on. Check out his work, artwolf.com. He's amazing. So.
But you did say, you did tease that this guest today
is
like your favorite
Ed.
Photographer. Yeah, pull the mic a little closer and introduce Ed Cashy.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd love to go through his, let me get this set. There we go. His accolades, but then that would be the entire hour of the show. So I'll just streamline it. He's been doing photography for 30 years now, and he's been published National Geographic, Time, Newsweek. He's won numerous awards, including UNICEF's Photo of the Year Award. I could go on. But the main thing that I love about Ed is he's an incredible person. He's really sharing, so I thought this would be a great platform for our viewers to learn, as well be inspired by his work. And he's just an awesome guy. And I'm finding out he's funny, too. And, I want to see the funny side of Ed in this interview.
And he's brilliantly handsome.
He is handsome.
Especially
I've thought that once or twice watching his interviews.
Hey, Ed, welcome to TWiT Photo. It's great to have
you. Hey, guys. How you doing?
So you're in Montclair, New Jersey.
Yeah.
The photo capital of the Eastern Seaboard.
All right. 12 miles outside of Manhattan.
He likes to introduce himself as New York City area.
Well, I was born in Manhattan. You don't give that up.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true. Your website, edkashi.com. And what I love is when photographers have websites with nice big images right up front. And you definitely do that. I love that.
So, Ed, what is Cashy? What is your heritage?
It's a cereal.
I wish I had a piece of that action.
How many times do you get that question?
A lot. Actually, back in the days of film in the 1990s, I had photo editors send my film from a shoot back in a Cashy cereal box.
Oh, my God.
Oh, how
that's
funny.
Hilarious.
Yeah. So, the name, my parents are both from Baghdad.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
Yep, and they immigrated to America in 1943.
Okay.
So the name Cashy comes from the city of Kashan in Iran.
It's interesting because you do a lot of pictures from the Middle East, at least judging from the front page of your website.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work over the last 20 years in the Middle East.
So I have actually, before we go in, I wanted to also, how we met was at Eddie Adams. And I think Eddie Adams is an awesome opportunity for beginning photographers, or even photographers that are a little bit established, to be inspired and learn and grow. So Ed, do you want to share your take on Eddie Adams? And by the way, you could go to Eddie, it's eddieadams.com, I think. Check it out.
Yeah.
How many times have you been there?
I've been there once, and I've had to turn them down, unfortunately, a couple of times. But they already booked me for next year, which I think is the 25th anniversary or something.
These are very famous photography workshops, and I think it's Eddie Adams Workshop.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, being there is such a privilege for a multitude of reasons. First of all, the setting is absolutely gorgeous, in upstate New York on a farm, and Eddie and his crew, whoever kind of organized the whole thing, they just knew how to do things right. You know, it was a time where there was a class to what they did, and the caliber of the work, the caliber of the instruction is just, it's as high as it gets, really. Probably the master class at the World Press in Amsterdam would be its only rival.
And the thing that's great about it is it's free. You know,
hold on. How could it be free?
Well, it's the students there. I'm not exactly sure how it's sponsored, but I went sometime this decade. And
that's awesome. You don't have to pay for it. Do you have to be
cheap.
A pro?
No, no. There's actually, they cut it. Do you know the guidelines? I can't remember.
I'm not sure, but it's really geared for students or, I can't remember the cutoff or the criteria, but or sort of beginning.
So
professionals.
Exactly.
So I could go because I'm definitely.
It's a good way to get your foot in the door if you
not a professional.
Yeah, if you love photography and when I applied, I honestly thought there's zero chance of me getting in. Like I almost didn't apply because it was like, what's the point? I'm not going to make it. And they actually picked me. So you never know. You got to try.
You can't be that way. You have to believe
yourself. I did it, Ed. I did it.
Okay, good.
So, anyway, I think we should start off. Can you go to his website? Look at his... My actual personal favorite, I think, body of work is your stuff from Nigeria. It's phenomenal. If you go...
should I go to published?
No.
Multimedia?
Go to
archive.
To essays.
Essays.
Wait. Yeah, and then go Delta and Slaughter. It's kind of being cut a little bit.
Yeah, that's probably me.
So I have a question. Okay, so Ed, getting started, you know, you've done a lot of work for News, Time, all these huge magazines that are sort of everyone's dream to get in. How did you initially, I know you started as an editorial photographer. What was your path into the more photojournalistic route that you've made your way to now?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, it actually took me a few years after graduating from college. I went to Syracuse University. I got a degree in photojournalism. And then I moved out to San Francisco. And this was in 1979. And it was a very different time then. The first couple of years, I did a lot of public relations photography, kind of anything that I would get paid. You know, I vowed to myself from the beginning that I would not be a waiter at night to be a photographer during the day, that I wanted to make my living by doing photography because I knew that any shoot I did, I would learn something. However stupid or, you know, kind of embarrassing the shoot might be, you know, like gripping grins for the Bank of America or you know, I remember I covered a sock hop for, you know, KSAN or something, one of the radio stations out there.
But at least you were working. That's the point.
Well, I was working and, you know, again, there's a quote and I'm probably butchered it, but it's a talisman from Ansel Adams where he said, you know, basically everything that he learned technically that he applied to his personal work, he learned through his commercial work. And I always sort of held on to that, you know, that so for instance, when you do a grip and grin of, you know, two suits shaking hands, handing over a check, and you think, oh my God, this is what I became a photographer for. But then you learn, well, what's it like to light in a fluorescent lit room with a high ceiling? And well, of course, you don't need to bother with these things now with digital cameras, right?
Yeah.
So you just put on auto white balance, but and jack it up to 1600. But then you had to deal. Well, but you know, then you had to deal with 30 magenta on your lens and a window green gel on your flash and all that sort of stuff. So then,
and
when
you
really
couldn't proof it. I mean, you'd have to know what you were doing.
You were bracketing and so forth and so on. You're bracketing your exposures. But then what would happen is when I was in a, you know, an orphanage in Poland or a heroin rehab center in Russia, and there was the same fluorescent light, I would go, right, okay, now I know how to handle this lighting situation to get the results I want. So I always tried to have a sort of positive attitude from the beginning, because, you know, I think anyone who does photography for a living has experienced this feeling of, you know, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know, this is not why I wanted to be a photographer. And it's those times where you really need to sort of suck it in and just sort of look at the positive side of it. And it's also, quite frankly, well, anyway, so I want to get back to that. So
did you keep, before you go on, did you keep a notebook as you were going and said of situations? I mean, how did you remember, for instance, that magenta light and what to do about it? Did you just have it in your head, or did you actually keep notes on these kinds of things?
No, I've never kept notes on technical stuff. I'm not.
His memory is better than yours, Leo.
Well, that's a given.
you know, I think a lot of it is, you know, for me with photography, I think with a lot of things, maybe it's just the way my mind works. But when I learned 30 magenta window green to deal with fluorescent light, it was like, that was it. I got it.
You knew
I didn't need to be told again. And I don't tend to test. I tend to sort of field test, if you like.
Learn
I don't
the field. Yeah,
exactly. And so what it means is it just penetrates into your head, because especially if you screw up, which thankfully I rarely do. Well, I've always said, you know, the mark of a professional isn't that you screw up. It's that you cover yourself. So I don't know about you guys, but during the film era, well, I never did this working with National Geographic or the major magazines, but at least once a year I would run a roll. I would do a bunch of shots and I'd realize I didn't have a roll of film on my camera, but I wouldn't announce it. I would just act like everything was cool.
Never admit it.
Oh, gosh, I've never done that.
Right? And so with digital, boys and girls, never in the menu item, never put shoot without a card.
Exactly. I learned that one the hard way myself.
You've done that?
Oh, yeah. I think everyone's done that before they change the setting.
Wow.
Because the default setting is shoot without card.
So that's lesson number one.
Yeah. Change your camera setting right now.
Right. Exactly.
It will happen to you. So were you doing – okay, so you're doing all this, let's just call it grunt crap work, but you're learning. Now, were you doing personal work on the side that helped you transition into the Nat Geo world, or how did that actual transition come about?
Well, yes. Thank you. So you keep me on track here, because I'm a digressor.
Oh, God. You're talking to the queen.
Yeah. Well, hopefully my digressions are valuable.
Actually, we were not, yours aren't. No, we were going to name this the Digression Network. So you're in the right place, boys and girls.
Right.
This is it. We're the rat hole kings here.
So, well, from the beginning, I've always done personal work. I think without personal work, I would die. I would shrivel up and die. And so while I was doing those sort of public relations stuff in the Bay Area, I was also pursuing personal projects. But the other thing that I did, and I don't know if that exists now, is there were all these sort of free arts publications. And I guess the Bay Guardian still exists and maybe East Bay Express, but a lot of free or very cheap arts publications. And I worked for all of them. I even photographed Andy Warhol for one of them. So I photographed actually a number of famous people as well as local Bay Area artists. And because they were not paying me, I could do whatever I wanted. So I was really into playing very early on with flash blur, especially in black and white. And so I was able to develop a portfolio and develop a personal approach to portraiture. And then on the side, I was also working on personal, more reportage projects. But, you know, I've always felt, I learned this early on, that there's a point in your life where you become a better photographer because you become a better human being. And that to some degree, you need to mature as a person to be able to really mature as a photographer, especially if you're trying to deal with very serious subjects and issues that invariably you do when you do documentary work or photojournalism. So for me, so what happened was then I started to get work from national magazines within about 3 years of graduating from college. And I was literally doing 10 to 15 magazine assignments a week.
Oh, wow.
I actually, there were days where I did 5 magazine assignments in one day. And I don't know if I should be proud of that. But anyway, and so then I woke up one day after about 5 years of that and said, well, this isn't why I wanted to be a photographer either, even though I was working for Time and Newsweek and Macworld and Fortune and Forbes and Business Week and all of that. You know, I was covering Silicon Valley in the 1980s, and it's like, this isn't why I became a photographer. So that's when I really struck out in 1988, so almost like 9 years after graduating from college, where I went to Northern Ireland to begin my first personal project that I feel really that showed my work had elevated to another level, and I had matured as a person as well as a photographer to be able to tackle something that was complicated and tough, and you know, thankfully produce a very compelling body of work. And that is what transitioned me to work with National Geographic and then sort of, you know, elevate to a different level of magazine work.
Were you always political, though? Because it seems your work is very political.
Well, you know, what's interesting. I grew up in the 60s and 70s in New York, in the New York area. And I remember when I was 10 years old, I was stuffing envelopes for, you know, Hubert Humphrey against Richard Nixon in 1968. And I
walked the streets for McGovern in 72. I know how you
right.
feel. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I was the music we were listening to. I remember one of the big pastimes for me and my close group of friends was collecting political buttons. And, you know, so it wasn't like my parents or anybody was telling me to do this. It's what sort of talked to my heart and it talked to my spirit. And I really believe it's because of the music of that time and just the general ethos of that time. So I grew up during the civil rights movement and the women's, you know, rights movement and the environmental movement and all these more progressive movements in America that actually really radiated around the world. And so that's imbued in me deeply. And what's interesting, though, is it took me almost a decade of being out of the university working to come around to apply what was inside of me to my work.
That's an important message that you don't necessarily get to do it right away, but if you keep that in your heart and you keep it in your goal, you can get there.
And would you say that, you know, pursuing, so it sounds to me like you're making a living and you wanted to make a living in photography. You wanted to stay in that field, so you weren't willing to waitress and do whatnot. So you'd rather take jobs.
I don't think he could ever waitress.
Wait. Oh, yeah, that would be bad. He's pretty, though.
No, I know what you're saying. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, so you chose not to do other things. You wanted to stay in the field, but you also were pursuing your personal work. Would you say that that pursuit is what led you to making the career that you have now? And if you hadn't done your personal work, you wouldn't be where you are today? And would that be something that you would encourage younger photographers to do, is follow that those personal work passions that they might have?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I teach and mentor a lot, and I all the time I say that is the key to success, not just in the profession but personally as well, is to find something you're passionate about, find something you care about, and it doesn't have to be political, whatever it is, it could be dogs, I don't care, whatever gets you going, you know, whatever turns you on. I mean, one of the great things about photography is that it's like a passport into worlds we otherwise would not enter.
Oh, so true. It's an excuse.
Yes. So if you like walking around the cities, you have an excuse to walk around cities and look at it in a way that you wouldn't if you didn't have a camera. You know, my original goal was I wanted to be Eugene Smith. You know, it was actually the photographer, where I had an epiphany was with Mary Ellen Mark's work. Not the work she's doing now, which is beautiful, but the work she was doing at the beginning of her career. And I remember looking at the book Ward 81, where she spent 3 months in an Oregon mental institution for women. And it was after she had shot stills on the set of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where that film was shot. And I mean, I guess this shows sort of how deranged I was, looking at pictures of sort of, you know, mentally disturbed women in black and white turned me on. And I said, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to spend 3 months on a really serious subject like this and make these incredible photographs. And, you know, that was it. And that is where, that was the moment. I must have been 18, 19 years old where I thought, I've caught the bug. I'm gone. That's it. And so, but I grew up looking at Life magazine, not National Geographic, actually. You know, I grew up looking at photo essays, the beautiful black and white photo essays in Life. And again, they were serious and dealt with both social issues as well as sort of geopolitical issues.
So do you see, I mean, you go to a lot of crazy places, and actually you are quoted by the editor of National Geographic, David Griffin, as fiercely going where...
Excuse me.
Fearlessly going...
Fiercely sneezing where no man has sneezed before.
Where few adventure. So do you foresee the places that you go, do you even see them as risky? And how do you, with having a family and all that, how do you psychologically handle that?
Excuse me if I start to have a sneezing fit.
That's okay.
But, yes, I absolutely see them as risky. I am not a cowboy. I mean, I'm actually a pretty gentle, sensitive person, and I take it very seriously when I go to these places in, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan or the Niger Delta, you know, many places, parts of Pakistan, and I am very respectful of the risks and the dangers that are involved. And it's not, the risks don't only just occur in war zones; they occur in many, many other sort of situations you can get into as a photojournalist. And, you know, I weigh those risks. And having a family, I have two teenage kids and, you know, an amazing wife who's stuck with me for almost 20 years through all this. I have to make decisions sometimes that go against my desires for work, you know. But if I don't have, if I cannot achieve this balance in my life, you know, I don't know how anyone survives who just has photography, this kind of photography, you know.
I'm guessing you get a little bit of a thrill out of it too. Do you enjoy the adventure?
Yeah, but how long can that last? I mean, you know, how many years or decades can you do that, you know, before I mean, how many hotel rooms, how many nights can you spend alone in a hotel room?
It does wear.
And, you know, you can win all these awards and you can be showered with praise and respect and attention and have your ego stroked as much as one, more than one could ever imagine. And yet at the end of the night, you're alone.
Yeah.
And actually nobody really gives a shit about you.
But you've got such good images, Ed. They're so beautiful. I mean, does that some consolation when you come home and you look at your light table and you say, wow.
Yes, of course, and that's what keeps you going. It's part of the rejuvenation process. There's something amazing that I've witnessed many, many times, and I actually, in the moment I'm in my life, I hope I witness it again. And that's where I feel so burnt out. I've been working so hard, or I'm depressed, or I can't imagine how I will carry on. And it could be like one great day of shooting, or it could be, you know, like I'll get sent away again and I'll think, forget it, I'm going to fall apart. And I have like a few amazing days of work and it's as though I went on a 1 month vacation. It's bizarre. Yeah. You know, and all of a sudden I have all my energy back. I have all my sort of, all my energy and my spirit back.
Sometimes, I wonder, there are great pictures around every corner. And yet, as we talk to these great photographers, I see that many of them need to go somewhere to do this. Do you think, Ed, that that's part of it, is to see things fresh, you need to actually travel?
Well, he's done a lot of work
locally,
personal work.
New Jersey
like,
stuff?
He did a whole series on living, on age. Well, you could have described that body of work. But I think that's a general misconception. Well, I feel like in the beginning of your career, you almost need to be inspired by something that's different. But as you develop as a photographer, as an artist,
that's
you start to see more in every day. Would you agree with that, Ed? And how has your career path been shaped by that?
Well, it can go both ways. For me, once I began doing the geopolitical work and working for the National Geographic and, you know, either sending myself abroad for personal projects or being sent abroad by magazines. And in the, you know, through the 90s and the, magazines would send me, you know, I got sent by Elle to Kuwait for a week to do a shoot on fashion in Kuwait. You know, those excitements don't exist anymore, or very, very rare. So you know, that was all great and exciting, and I love it, and I still love doing that. But there was a point in the mid-90s where I realized I needed to turn my camera on my own culture and my own society, and then I began the project on aging in America, and I spent 8 years working on that. And quite frankly, it's not done. After we published the book and did a documentary and the website and exhibitions and all that in 2003, 3 years later, we then moved, actually a year later, we moved to New Jersey to take care of my father-in-law, who was starting to, you know, show signs of dementia and, you know, couldn't live alone anymore. And from all we learned during the project on aging, certainly for me, it was clear we couldn't allow Herbie to be warehoused, that we needed to take care of him. And as I've said many times, that this was a case where being a journalist made me a better human being. You know, that I really might have been much more selfish if I had never done the work on aging. And I would have thought like, I'm not going to stop traveling. I'm not going to stop doing what I do. We'll put Herbie in a nice, you know, assisted living facility. But after seeing all that I saw over those that 8 year period, we went to 25 states. I mean, I spent months and months and months on the road working on this project. It was like there was no way we were going to let Herbie do anything but live in our home and die in our home, so that he would finish his life with comfort, dignity, and respect. Because without him, I wouldn't have the life I have. Yeah. I wouldn't have Julie, and I wouldn't have the life I had. And I think it breaks my heart how in this youth-obsessed culture we live in, we take this sort of both the beginning of life and the end of life for granted.
Yeah, how, you know, I think of...
By the way, we're watching the Living with Herbie documentary that's on the AARP site.
So, yeah, and so, and thank you. You know, and so I want to get back, Catherine, to what you were saying, that so I've experienced, I've had the fortune, excuse me, to experience both working very far away and working in my home. Right. Ruth shot two films in my home. And I'll tell you, there were times, especially when we did the second film about Herbie, where I was resentful that my house had become the field.
Right.
You know, that I wanted to go home.
Let me and out
I
wanted of here. To chill.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah. And now I'm home and I'm thinking, oh, that's a good moment. Oh, geez,
gosh,
I have to pick up a camera.
I can't even imagine.
Oh, it was torturous the second time, but we did it because we were commissioned, and also we knew that it was an important thing to do. But I want to just backtrack because you said, you suggested that people at the beginning of the career have to go far, and quite often that is the model. But I would suggest you look at someone like Jessica Dimmock or Lauren Greenfield. You know, there are two examples. Matt Eich, here's a recent one, E-I-C-H. But particularly the first two, those women, you look at, they did a project, they spent years on it, and it blasted open their career. And in the case of Jessica Dimmock, it was heroin addicts on the 9th floor in Manhattan. So she didn't even leave the city she lived in. Yeah. So I would just say that while, yes, going to Afghanistan or Libya or wherever you can make your career, you don't need to do that. What you need to do is work on something you believe in, and you are absorbed. You're engaged in, because that's where you'll produce the greatest work.
Do you have advice specifically for photographers that are not necessarily sure how to decide what should be a big body of work to invest in? Maybe they aren't necessarily passionate about something specific yet. How would you recommend them getting started when they may not have the budget to be traveling, or they may not have a specific idea, like, I live next to a house that has heroin addicts. I'm going to document that.
That's a great tease. Hold that thought. We'll let you answer in a second, Ed.
I'm giving you some time.
Time to think while we talk about one of our two great sponsors on this show, and a really appropriate sponsor for Twit Photo. It's squarespace.com, the secret behind exceptional websites. You know, every photographer has to have a portfolio. And nowadays, you've got to have a portfolio online. There's no easier way to do it than Squarespace.com. One of the reasons is Squarespace includes everything you need. It includes the hosting. It includes the great content management software that makes Squarespace so exceptional. I want you to try it today, right now, at Squarespace. Let me turn this off. Squarespace.com/, and I think I have to change this lower third because it's not mostly photo. It's Twit Photo 6. Actually, go to squarespace.com You don't need any URL. And then if you decide to buy, if you use TwitPhoto 6, you're going to save 30% for the first 3 months. So that's actually even more relevant. TwitPhoto 6. So what is Squarespace? It's hosting plus the best content management software out there. Really good stuff that allows you to quickly design a website from scratch, right from the beginning. In fact, take a look at some of the examples of photography portfolios that some of these great photographers and companies have put together. You'll see this is all done with Squarespace. That's the amazing thing about Squarespace. It makes it possible in seconds, in minutes, to set up an amazing site that it really shows you off beautifully. I want you to give it a try right now. Squarespace.com. Visit it. There's a big try it free button if you go right there to the front page, squarespace.com. And then if you decide you like it after the 2 weeks free, use the offer code TwitPhoto6 and you'll get the first 3 months at 30% off. So it really is a very affordable way to see if this is the site for you. Squarespace.com, and then give it a try at TwitPhoto6. We really like what they do at Squarespace, and we thank them for their support of TwitPhoto. All right. Your respite is over. Your time to think is over. Do you want to restate the question, Catherine, in case our audience has forgotten? This is a very, very apropos question.
Oh, yeah.
How do you choose your body of work? How do you?
Yeah, I mean, if you're not necessarily inspired by being abroad or by having something really extreme in your natural living environment, how do you come up with for emerging photographers, what's a way to come up with project ideas?
That's such a great question, and that's why I think I really believe that's why there's such tremendous value if let's say you're still in college or at that stage in your life to study other things. You know, that it
not,
makes no
not
sense.
Photography.
Exactly, because anybody, not anybody can learn photography, but you don't need to spend $200,000 for a 4-year education at a great university to learn photography. You go there to learn about the world, to learn about yourself, to figure out what you care about, you know?
I really concur with that. You know, people ask me, how do you get in broadcasting? Same thing. If you're an interesting person, you'll bring that to your work, and that's really more important than...
studying Chinese at Yale
didn't
bring you here?
Didn't, no. In fact, it was completely useless, but it gave me an interest in the world, and I think that's important.
I completely agree, and when I think about... if I were to go back, I would actually go back in either psychology or marketing or business, something that would because photography, I mean, how do you feel about this, Ed? As far as formal education is concerned, it's been great for me, but more often than not, most of what I've learned has actually just been practice, just getting out there and shooting. What's your take on that?
No, I agree that including photography, everything I've learned since I left school.
Uh-huh.
And again, to address your question, because there are lots of people who might be past their college days or, that period in their lives and are at the beginning of their careers or into their careers as a photographer. I mean, to answer your question, unfortunately you have to care about something. I'm sorry. If you want to do photojournalism, forget just photojournalism. If you love fashion, I mean, you have to care about shoes or
right.
or fabric or.
There's
color.
My problem. I knew there was something wrong.
But that's the thing about photography is that it gives you this excuse, for lack of a better word, it gives you a reason to explore something.
Right.
And, of course, we're exploring it visually, primarily. But, again, as a journalist, you're exploring it with narrative, with words, with multimedia, the voice of the subjects, music, sound, ambient sound. So you have to genuinely care. You have to genuinely be interested in the world. You have to be curious. And I'm telling you, if you do not have those qualities, then you probably really don't want to be a photojournalist, or you shouldn't be. Not that you shouldn't be, but that it's probably going to be a tough fit for you.
Interesting.
Well, I think a lot of it, too, goes back to trial and error and practice. You may love photography but not know what type you're most passionate about until you actually start doing it. So for me, I started doing architecture, and I was doing landscape, and, nothing really resonated 100%. And then I started shooting people, and it was like a big duh moment, you know? So it was just a matter of getting out there and shooting. And then what I was passionate about, and this goes back to what you were saying, Ed, you know, you evolve as a person. And I've realized that shooting people was something that hit home and allowed, you know, that was a type of photography that I could bring something special to the world with. So it's a path, I guess. So what I actually am really interested, one of the things that I find fascinating about your photojournalistic work is oftentimes photojournalists are back far sort of as safe as you can be with a 70 to 200 lens or a bigger lens, who knows. And you get a feeling of they're sort of watching as things are happening, but not necessarily involved. Whereas your work, you're up in it and you're really, really close to your subjects. Why do you prefer being in that zone where it could possibly be more risky and you're definitely involved in some pretty intense situations?
Well, I think it's because that's how I am as a person, is I like to be up close and personal. That's just how I am. That, you know, and in my work, I've come to coin the term candid intimacy. That's how I see my work, where you feel very close and very intimate to the subjects, but there's no sense that I'm there, except, of course, for the work on my father-in-law. But apart from that, you know, those are the qualities that I strive for.
Do you use a long lens for that, or these look wide,
you know,
for the most part?
I tell you, I shoot, well, right now my favorite lens is the 24-105. I worked with Canons when I was shooting with Leicas. My favorite lens was the 35-14 or the 28-28. And, you know, probably 90% of my work has been shot between, I'd say, 24 and 35 mil zone. And I have the 200, but I sometimes, most of the time, I don't even bring it out in the field. And then when I do, I often don't use it. You know, and I'll tell you, though.
You get in there, and that's what's great. I mean, it really is intimate.
Yeah, how do you get, so you have this candid intimacy where you're really in there. My question is, how do you get so close but still maintain that sort of, it feels like you're capturing a moment, they're not aware of you.
Aha, well, that's the art of this, isn't it? And, you know, I think it's because of the way I am. That I've learned to stick my chest out and be strong and raise my voice, and I've learned to make myself small and even like literally get on my knees. You know, that, and I don't always get it right, but you know, I'm very, very tuned into that. You know, that I think is one of the keys, is this sense of understanding human nature and reading a situation and thinking, boy, you know, I want to photograph is feeling vulnerable. Well, the last thing I want to do is tower over them. You know, that I need to get low and I need to make myself small and I need to have my voice be gentle. Or there are times when I'm working and people, it's a very aggressive scene and I know that I have to sort of stick my chest out and be tough and point my finger and be demanding or whatever it may be. You know, even though if they only knew, I'm a total pussycat. But it, because of my size and the way I look, I often can get away with appearing aggressive. So those are the qualities of, I guess, really managing human nature. One could even say manipulating people. I mean, ultimately, this kind of work is about a certain manipulation, but I do it with a good heart, you know, for a good purpose, not to abuse people, not to rob them of their dignity. So. You know, that's just the nature of this. You can't always behave the way you're supposed to behave, especially working in other cultures, especially working a lot in the Muslim world, where, you know, just to photograph women is such a, you know, can be a huge task. And so, you know, I hate to step on people's mores and culture, and I don't want to hurt anybody. Again, another great quote from Cartier-Bresson about how he talked about the impact he has on his subject, and that, you know, his assignment was to photograph a bed of tulips, he would shoot it from every angle, but when he was done, he would leave no footprint in the bed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that idea. So as much as is possible, these are the kinds of This is the ethos that I try to work by. And I tell you, this is just common sense that because I behave this way most of the time, people react more warmly to me. And they are more open and they are more trusting. I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, I can't believe I just told you that.
Yeah.
You know, it was really good when I was single too. But anyway, I appreciate that because it also is a reminder that you have to be incredibly respectful. You have to cherish what people give you because they're giving you a piece of themselves and they are opening themselves up. And so I'm not trying to get that so that I can then trample on it or twist it and abuse it, you know? I mean, granted, there are times where I photograph sort of bad guys, and that's a different kind of – that's a different thing. But most of the time, you know, I'm photographing just regular people who might be in difficult or unusual circumstances, and my goal is not to take advantage of their situation. It's to just try to show the situation, but with a kind of intimacy and a warmth and a kind of visual complexity so that it becomes absorbing and the multi-layered in its meaning.
So that's actually, that ties in with one of your tips, your three tips for today, which is maintaining the dignity of your subjects while you're shooting them. Just to reiterate that.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that I saw on your interview with Mark Silver, which by the way was a great interview, that really stuck with me as a very powerful statement was, this is as provocative as this. And I find that so true and so interesting. And I know you combat that with often shooting from the hip.
For people who are listening, not watching.
Yeah, not
although,
watching,
while
yeah.
you would watch a listen to a photographer.
I'm making it so they have to go watch it later. No, I'm just kidding.
This was a square.
Like a camera, like you're holding up your camera. And is the, as provocative
as a pistol.
As holding up a gun.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could explain what you mean by that and also how you combat that, perhaps by shooting from the hip or some of your techniques.
Yeah. Well, I do feel that I do feel this has changed in the last 30 years since I've been working as a photographer, particularly in the last 10, 20 years. That the gesture of bringing the camera up to my eye in the way we normally would to make a photograph, it completely changes the situation. You know, there's so many places, not just in Pakistan or societies where, you know, you have a lot of cultural, let's say roadblocks, if you like, for making photographs openly and freely. But even in America, I can be on the streets of New York where you would think, oh my God, everybody is so jaded about photography. I bring the camera up to my eye and all of a sudden everybody's looking at me.
Yeah.
Some people might already be thinking that man, he better not photograph me or else I'm going to, you know, like, yeah. And I'm like, wow, I'm just going to take a picture here. And what I do is I almost have a third sense now, and it's not always a good thing because I bet I probably inhibit myself at times when I shouldn't, but I've learned some tough lessons by being assaulted and by having incredible situations destroyed because of the camera awareness. So, but some of the reactions, the reason I liken it to, you know, holding a gun is that the reactions sometimes are so violent and so frightened that I'm amazed. It's like, it's just a camera, guys. You know, is a picture of you that threatening? You know,
and yet you are in Northern Ireland where, I mean, or Iraq, or, I mean, here's Baghdad where there's very heavy situations going down, and you're right there.
You're right there.
It's amazing.
How do you know your composition, you're getting what you want in frame while you're shooting from the hip?
Well, you know, that's another element of the digital revolution. It's connected to the digital revolution in the way my style of making photographs has changed. You know, I always say when I worked with a Leica, you know, you sort of pack. You take a picture, take a couple of pictures. You know, you do these adjustments, and you're sort of pecking away. And now with these auto-winder cameras where I'm often using autofocus, you know, and I'm really working in a more fluid way. And because I've now been shooting video for over 10 years and working in multimedia and thinking in sequences and thinking with much more movement in mind, there are times where I will take the camera, I'll lock my focus on wherever I want to be focused, and I'll just press the shutter and I'll move the camera up and down or sideways or in and out, or you'll get up from your chair and start walking and I'll just follow you. You know, it's almost like using it like a video camera. And what's exciting to me about that is that there's so much magic that comes from that. You know, and it's the antithesis of Bresson's The Decisive Moment, actually, you know, where, you know, in his case, you're lining up everything so perfectly, almost like a scientist, and then waiting for that emotional moment and then, boom, snapping the shutter. I mean, in my case, I'm sensing a variety of dynamics that are going on in the situation. Usually there's movement involved, and or there's angles that I want to get. Like I want to shoot from my feet, but I don't want to lie on the ground, you know, or I want to shoot from above, but I have nothing to climb on, you know, and it's just playing a lot more, just playing. And then as you guys alluded to earlier, because of the immediate feedback with the digital camera, I can, you know, I try not to do this too much, but I try not to chimp too much, but I can, you know, it's like I call it a roid on the go.
Yeah.
You know, Polaroid on the go. So it'd be like, I can walk into a situation, take a shot, look at it, go great. You know, lighting is great, exposure is great. And then just go with it and then dance and play. So shooting from the hip for more security or reasons to be incognito, I guess I've just learned over the years, you know, with the lens, the focal length I'm working with, roughly what I'm going to get. But I can't know for sure, and that's kind of the magic of photographing in this way. And I can't tell you how many pictures I love that I've made in the last few years in this style that are really very successful photographs, but I was not looking through the viewfinder.
So you speak, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about goes back to being discreet. What gear, can you tell us what's in your bag? What gear
Before
are you using
you
that allow?
That.
Oh, there you go.
And I want to ask him what post-processing software he uses, because that's one of our favorite topics on
Great.
The show, too. But before we do that, Ed Kashi is our guest, edkashi.com. Lots of great photos on his website. That's always nice to see those big shots. You can really admire his work and absolutely can do that at edkashi.com. But before we get back to Ed, I want to mention a little bit about our friends at netflix.com. And if you're not a Netflix member, I got to ask myself, are you really serious about watching television? Do you really care about movies? Because if you're not a member, man, you're missing out. Netflix lets you watch thousands of movies and TV shows right there on your Mac or your PC or your iPhone or your iPad, on many Android phones, on your Xbox 360, on your Wii, on your PlayStation 3, on Roku boxes. That's how I watch. I'm watching Netflix pretty much every
I
night.
Have to wonder why they even have to have ads.
They don't. And this has been a problem, is that
like,
nobody is signing up.
Doesn't everyone have Netflix?
You all have it. So if you're the one person watching right now who doesn't yet have Netflix, just do me a favor. Go to netflix.com/twit and sign up for a free 30-day trial, and you'll see what all the excitement is about.
I got it for my grandma. And I just put on the old – I stream the old movies for her.
That's
and
a great
like
idea.
She's like in pig heaven.
Yeah. She just sits there and watches old movies all the time. This is the watch instantly thing. We can go right to classics and see the broad variety of old movies available at netflix.com. Gone with the Wind, The Sting, Funny Girl. Oh, and Affair to Remember. We watched that. That was so great with Cary Grant, Patton, Rock. I mean, they call now, wait a minute. Rocky Horror Picture Show, a classic comedy. I guess it is now. The Hustler, The Graduate, Betty Grable, The Beautiful Blonde, Bashful from Bashful Bend.
What's your favorite Netflix movie that you've recently watched?
Well, you know, that's the fun thing about Watch Instantly, is you can go right there and see what I've recently watched. We just watched a very funny,
A Wrinkle in Your Time, your favorite movie.
Actually, Abby and I watched that last night. It was actually quite good. It's a great kids book.
I just went to Kung Fu Panda.
There you go.
It was really good.
There you go. Here's the beauty of this.
Not as good as the first, though.
Yeah, the beauty of it is you can watch these movies instantly. So, you know, if it turns out to be a bad movie, you just go to the next one. McClintock. I love John Wayne movies. I know that's a guilty pleasure, but I do. I love the cowboy movies. It's How to Murder Your Wife. Interesting. You got to be careful about what you watch because it does show up in the watch. What you've watched recently.
Well, you do when you're Leo and everything's publicized.
It's public. No, I love Netflix. I want you to try it free for 30 days. And you know what? For grandma or anybody in your family who hasn't yet tried it, this is a great way to introduce them to it. And then if they love it, they've got gift certificates. My mom gets it every year on her birthday, gets a year's worth of Netflix, and she loves it. Netflix.com/twit. Give it a try. Today. All right. Now, time for What's in Your Bag, Ed Cashy. So go ahead. Apparently, he doesn't carry a bag.
Yeah, enlighten us.
What's the deal?
How are you the photo ninja?
Well, you know, this gets back to wanting to dance when I shoot. That, you know, wanting to be fluid and not feel encumbered. You know, when I see these dudes with like 300-pound bags on their shoulders and massive lenses, I would not be able to think straight. I admire them for their strength. So what I've done is kind of perfected for myself a very simple kit. I tell you, most of the time, literally 90% of the time now, I go out, if I'm not shooting video, if I'm just shooting stills, I go out with one camera, a 5D Mark II, and the 24-105 lens.
The kit lens, ladies and gentlemen.
That's it. And then I'll have, back in the car, in my hotel room, or whatever, another 5D with the 16-35. And I'll only bring that lens out when I it's a more of a problem-solving lens where I'm going to be in a situation that's maybe very tight quarters and right. I need to have a wider view or I need to have an expansive view outside. But otherwise, I like to avoid being too wide-angle because I feel it. I don't like the distortion. Anyway, and then I have a belt with a flash in one pouch that has a cord to take it off my camera, extra batteries, then a wallet for my CF cards, which I have enough, you know, I probably carry around like 80 gigs a day or something.
Wow.
Not that I've ever shot that much, except in shooting video. And then I've got a third pouch with I still have a Filofax along with my iPhone. I still have a Filofax and you know, and a caption book. And extra batteries for the camera. I mean, really, that's it. So a very simple fanny pack or, you know,
rock a fanny pack?
What's that?
You rock a fanny pack?
He's a macho dude. He does nothing to be ashamed of.
You know what?
Of.
I rock a fanny pack, too.
Yeah, okay. But you look better than me with it.
No.
No one looks good with a fanny pack.
Fanny pack is so not okay.
No one looks good in a fanny pack.
Well, it's true. It's true. You know, I generally look... Well, you know, the standard joke is I'll have something important and I'll get dressed and we'll go downstairs and ask my family how'd I look and they go, "You're a photographer, it doesn't matter."
Yeah.
And I'll go, "Thanks a lot." You know, it's like but when I'm working in the field, most of the time I think what's important in terms of your appearance is that you blend in. Really, that's actually a very important element, and it's connected to a number of the things we've already talked about, that I don't want to stand out. I don't wear bright colors. You know, I always said I want to look like the janitor or the gardener. I want to just blend in. But if someone looks at me and scrutinizes me, they'll see that I have my act together.
Nowadays, I think carrying a 5D with a relatively normal-looking lens isn't perhaps a mark of a pro anymore.
No, it's not. It's shifted. Yeah. So you never have two bodies on you at any time. Do you ever feel
occasionally
inhibited by that?
You mean when I do carry two bodies?
I mean, do you ever feel like, you have the 24-105, so that's a pretty big zoom range. When do you carry two bodies, and what's the reasoning behind it?
Oh, it would be if I'm two things, basically. Either I know that I will not have access to my car. You know, I will not have a safe place that's nearby that I have access to grab the extra gear if I need it. Or I'm, you know, like if there's a day where I'm just out for the day and I have to have everything with me, then I'll carry my little donkey bag with the extra camera. And the extra lens. So most of the time, though, I'm working. It seems recently, most of the time, I'm working with just one camera. You know, and it just keeps. I'm less obtrusive. It's simple. I can react.
It's a pretty good kit. Just that 5D Mark II and a 24-105. That's really all you need.
When I go to Burning Man and I can't, you can't change lenses there because of the dust. 24-105.
Yep.
All the way.
Yeah,
it's a nice... It covers what you know what I need. I don't shoot very long usually either, so it works out.
So Jay, you came back. You've got your 16 gigs of shots. What do you do next?
Okay, so post production, huh?
Yeah.
Well, obviously we use Photoshop, but I use Expressions Media.
Interesting. Microsoft's product.
Right. Well, yeah. No. Now they just sold it to Phase One.
Good.
Right, which we are.
Microsoft did nothing with it.
Well, they kind of made it worse in a way. They didn't screw it up, but they made it less beautiful and all that. But thank goodness it's hopefully been rescued, because for me, Aperture and Lightroom are amazing products, but they're like a sledgehammer to kill an ant. It's just too much. And you know, I'll tell you though, when I teach, if someone says that, you know, like I haven't yet invested in this, you know, digital asset management software yet, I will suggest Lightroom, because in the end of the day, it's probably the smartest product. Nothing against Aperture. I love Apple. I'm an Apple freak, but Lightroom really is a great product. But for me, it's too much. And there's something else that I don't like about Lightroom and Aperture, and please correct me if maybe I've fallen behind on how they work, but I want to be able to see the folder that my pictures are in. You know, I don't want this icon that has everything. That I want to have I don't know if transparency is the right word, but I want to be able to manage my content where I there's a structure of folders, and I know how many images are in each folder, and I've got a catalog that connects to those folders. So because invariably we always create derivatives from our RAWs, and so I find Expressions Media does everything I needed to do, from ingestion to archiving and metadata, which I do every night, I run my digital archive in my studio, which has about 22,000 images in it now, you know, and then to presentations, because it plays QuickTime as well as stills. So for me, Expressions Media, which I believe now has been renamed Media Pro by Phase One with this new, this purchase of it, is the best product to work with. For managing my archives and, you know, again, as I said, everything from ingestion to presentation.
So I'm glad you mentioned this. For one thing, I didn't realize Microsoft had finally offloaded it, which is great. But it's Peter Krogh who wrote the Dam book. And, of course, we traveled to Tasmania with Peter.
Yeah, we did.
I asked him the same question, and he surprised me when he said Expressions Media. So I'm actually glad that you mentioned this.
That was the first time I've heard this.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but he says the same thing, which is, for managing all that media, and that's what Peter's all about, this is a good solution. So it is now at Phase One, and as you say, it's called Media Pro One Photo Manager, which I would not have known. So I'm glad you told me that they've bought it and renamed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just happened a month ago.
I mean, you know, another reason that I extol Lightroom, I know this is sort of a weird message here because I don't use Lightroom, but what, you know, one of the advantages of it is that, if especially as a photojournalist, where you're not, you know, putting people's heads on, you know, donkey bodies or whatever, you know, that you're basically just doing, you know, basic darkroom work. I believe with Lightroom, you probably have enough moves in Photoshop moves that you almost don't even need Photoshop.
I think that's true. Yeah.
Right. You know. So unless you're a photo retoucher.
Yeah. Right. For a photojournalist, that would be a great software.
Oh, yeah. It's the right solution, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is fun. I'm having a great time. We got some Q&A. Should we indulge ourselves in the Q&A?
Sure. Or sounds good.
You want to ask some more questions of Ed? We've got him here. We've got a few more minutes. How about a question concerning editing on a MacBook Pro with an LED backlit display? This comes from Simon B. He says, I'm finding that when I'm editing a photo with a screen set to its brightest, my photos are coming out underexposed when displayed in another monitor. How do you know? I have the same problem, too. A lot of when I put my stuff on Flickr, a lot of it's dark because I guess my screen is too bright. You calibrate your screens.
Yeah,
you must.
I use Data Color to calibrate. And, you know, like my MacBook Pro, it was awful out of the gate. You know, it was like very contrasty and very green.
Yep.
So if I edited photographs on that without calibrating it, it would be really bad.
People think you got no eye.
So exactly. So if you're going to be using a laptop, I highly recommend definitely calibrating it with some sort of tool.
Do you calibrate your monitors, Ed? Do you have some?
Yeah, and we use Datacolor as well. Okay. I'll every so often calibrate my laptop, and I use an Apple Cinema display when I'm in my studio as a second monitor, and I'll calibrate that as well. I don't know. Some people don't calibrate; they just use these particularly Apple screens out of the box, and they seem to be okay. But frankly, that's one of the biggest conundrums with the digital revolution. With this digital work process, is that, as you're suggesting, you can't guarantee that the way it looks on your screen is going to look online or on your editor's screen, for that matter. So I think these standards are improving, and it is getting better. But I think I absolutely believe in calibration tools to really minimize this happening, where you it looks beautiful on your screen, you send it off, and it looks like crap on another screen.
Yeah, definitely.
One more from Tommy B. I'm a high school student starting to experiment with photography. Is there a beginner book you recommend? Anybody have a suggestion?
Ed, you've read six books. You could be a good
Let's recommend Ed's books. How about that?
right. Wow, a beginner's book. It's been a long time since I've looked at photo books, so I couldn't say. But maybe the thing to do, on the one hand, you want to be inspired aesthetically, in terms of your visual approach. So while they still exist, go to a bookstore and go to the photography section, find the bookstore with the biggest photography section and look through photo books and then see what turns you on. Is it Robert Frank? Is it Richard Avedon? Is it me? Is it whoever it may be? What kind of photography turns you on? The approach, color, black and white, reportage, fashion, so forth and so on. And that will at least begin to teach you about the visual language. But in terms of the sort of the nuts and bolts of learning about photography, I am not a good person to
you already
suggest.
Know.
Exactly.
You figured
exactly.
It out a few years
back. Is there
back.
A particular book that you've read that
I'm trying
really
to remember,
helpful?
Is it Derek Story has a good book of basic digital photography book that I think is a good start. But I would agree with Ed that really looking at pictures is a great thing to do. Look at as many pictures as you can and see why you like those pictures.
And then also just the blogs that are out there.
There's
now.
So many great ones.
That, just following photography educational blogs. And
Luminous Landscape is wonderful. There's so many great places you can.
So that's, I know Scott Bourne has a great blog. Going pro, if you're a little bit more advanced, is another good one. Rick Salmon has a great blog. Ed has a blog.
You have a blog.
I have a blog.
CatherineHall.net.
So that's one way to get, and you can look at all these blogs and see which ones resonate with you most, and then I would follow those, and that's a way to get current, stay on top with current information. That's the one, I would say, setback of books is that things change while they're being published. So
hey, here's a good site, edkashi.com. Lots of great pictures in here. And Ed does a lot of video, too, which we didn't even really ask about. But maybe next time you come back.
Yeah, I know. Video. Well, he was kind of like the pioneer of multimedia.
Yeah.
Him and Brian Storn did a lot of work.
A lot of
together,
really interesting multimedia projects on here that you might want to check out at his website. Ed, so nice to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, guys.
Ed, thank you so much for coming on Skype.
Right.
edkashi.com. Thanks, Ed.
All right. Take care. Keep up the great work.
Thanks.
Bye, Catherine. Bye, guys.
Hey, before we wrap up, I want to mention one more thing, which is we have the contest is going to be kind of an ongoing thing because we're putting up a new website. We're going to migrate to twitphotoadventures.com, but it's not up yet. And we're going to create a new Twit Photos Flickr group, too, for your entries. So
we're trying to get everything 100% in place.
Moved over.
And then we'll announce the specifics of the next contest.
Maybe by the 4th of July or the 5th of July, we'll have something for you.
When we're not forgetting the contest that we threw out there.
In fact, there's two.
There's the flags and then there's the light.
Soft light.
Soft light one. So
keep taking those pictures and we'll let you know where to put them as soon as we've got the stuff going.
I'm excited to see them. Some of them are already on the Mostly Photo.
So you can also put
you can re-upload.
Yeah. Hey, thank you everybody for being here. Catherine Hall is a fantastic photographer. If you want to know more about her, you can go to her website, CatherineHall.net, for some amazing images.
Or Twitter, Catherine_Hall.
Catherine_Hall on Twitter. Yeah. I will add that to my Twitter list of photographers
I
follow.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for tuning in.
We'll see you next time on Twit Photo. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Yay. Now, Ed, you're going to try to get your head in the same place Catherine's is.
Well, I can't be as beautiful. That's the problem.
Well, no, but you could arrange your camera to at least put you in the same spot on the frame if you could.
Okay, wait a second. What are you saying?
I know you don't know how to do that, but...
Just shift the computer.
Oh, is this what you mean? Like this?
Well, I would shift the computer as opposed to you, but...
Okay, so shift the computer.
See where she is and where you are.
Other way.
Other way. There you go. A little more. And then little less headroom. So if you get your tilted forward.
You know that tuning up is like the least.
Yeah, perfect.
Angle, right?
Look at that.
So hold on.
That's the problem is that with most computers, most laptops, you always are shooting up, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's the only negative about a laptop.
That's why I come to the studio.
Yeah. Well, you look,
everyone
I mean,
thinks I'm nice.
Look how gorgeous she is.
Aww, thank you.
Look at that.
I'll take it up. I'll soak it in.
It's the velvet curtains, actually. They make everybody look beautiful. You know that.
And do you like that lighting better?
Let's see here. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Add some drama. There's a little sun. There's a glass shadow, kind of. You know, I can work with it. Oh.
Ooh. We want some modeling. Ooh. Beautiful. Ooh. No, that looks great. That really looks good.